Lecture 72, The Affluent Society.
In the last couple of lectures, we've looked at some of the foreign policy implications of America's Cold War situation. Now let's look at what was happening inside the United States at the same time in the late 40s and the 1950s. The Second World War had witnessed a dramatic redistribution of income throughout society. Good wages, full employment, and generous veterans benefits for the millions who'd served in the war contributed to a transformation of everyday life in America. High incomes and widespread possession of cars among working people enabled them to buy houses in the proliferating new suburbs, which grew very rapidly in this period. The high birth rate created the baby boom, while consumer goods manufacturers and advertisers took advantage of steady rises in available discretionary income. America sprawled in the 1950s and became incomparably the wealthiest society in the entire history of the world. Anxiety about the Cold War peril was offset by domestic luxury and a sense of almost boundless, technologically enhanced possibilities for the future. The Soviet Union's surprise victory in the space race in 1957 led to a new American dedication to education in science and technology. Meanwhile, the economist John Kenneth Galbraith, whose book The Affluent Society gave a name to the era, reminded Americans that they'd not yet achieved social balance in the expenditure of their newfound wealth. Well, as I said, first thing, income was more widely distributed after the Second World War than it had been before, and it contributed to a sustained economic boom. The great fear during the war had been that, just as depression conditions seemed to be permanent in the 1930s, maybe the depression would come back again as soon as the war had ended and demand sank. That didn't happen. Far more people were prosperous than ever before. And of course, there were still poor people in America, as we shall see. But now they were identifiable, and increasingly, poverty was becoming the aberration. America could actually ask questions now like, why is there poverty? Whereas throughout the vast majority of the history of the world, the question had always been, why is there wealth? Because poverty was such a normal condition for nearly everyone. That's what Adam Smith had done in his great book in 1776, an inquiry into the wealth of nations. Why should somebody be wealthy? Now Americans are so wealthy that they can ask, why should anybody be poor? The GI Bill, passed unanimously by Congress in 1944, enabled war veterans, people who'd served in the armed forces, to gain low-cost education and very favorable terms on mortgages to buy their own homes. And 8 million veterans took advantage of its provisions to go to college. About 5 million took advantage of the low-interest loans to buy their own homes. So the combined effect of these was to dramatically raise the number of Americans graduating from college every year, from about 160,000 per year in the 1930s to 500,000 per year, half a million college graduates by 1950. Along with the education is this new pattern of residence. New suburbs sprawled across the American landscape. One of the most famous was Levittown, a mass-produced suburban community, prefabricated and then built at very, very high speed. William Levitt did the same kind of innovations in the housing business that Henry Kaiser had done in building the Liberty ships, that is, standardizing the models, prefabricating the components, and then erecting them much more quickly than ever before. In 1947, Levittown was built and opened, 17,500 new houses, a sort of instant city. Here's an admiring article from the New York Times about Levittown from that year, 1947, an admiring article about Levitt and his brother who'd actually done it. Quote, starting from scratch, the Levitts will have converted 8 square miles of open farm country into a densely populated community of 70,000 people. Paved streets, sewer lines, school sites, baseball diamonds, shopping centers, parking lots, a new railroad station, factory sidings, churches, trunk arteries, newspapers, garden clubs, swimming pools, doctors, dentists, and the town hall. All conceived in advance, all previously planned in one of the most colossal acts ever of mortal creation. And a great achievement to suddenly build this new town. The great complaint of dwellers in new suburban communities was that very often the houses lacked individuality. They were too similar to one another. But of course, it wasn't long before the individual dwellers in these houses did everything they could to find ways to vary them. Listen now to Tom Wolfe writing about 30 years later about the way in which American first-generation suburbanites decorated their own homes. He says, quote, "They added gaslight-style front porch lamps and mailboxes set up on lengths of stiffened chain that seemed to defy gravity. The more cute and antique-y touches, the better. And they loaded these houses with drapes, such as baffled all description, and wall-to-wall carpet you could lose a shoe in. And they put barbecue pits and fish ponds in, with concrete cherubs urinating into them, on the lawn out back. And they had Evin Rude cruisers up on tow trailers in the carport just beyond the breezeway." Tom Wolfe's wonderful for exaggerating, but getting to the heart of something through the exaggeration. Many areas of America were growing rapidly, especially the area that we now call the Sun Belt. That is, cities like San Diego and Los Angeles, Phoenix, Houston and Dallas, Atlanta and Miami. Low-population cities, when the whole point... These are cities built with the automobile in mind right from the beginning. Rather than having concentrated downtowns like the old industrial cities had had, these are places where the governing assumption is people will use automobiles to get around, and so everybody can have a little patch of land on which their house will be built, and it'll all be spread out. So the car had made these places possible, but so had the perfection of air conditioning, which was also one of the goods, at first a luxury, quickly becoming a necessity, which spread very rapidly in the 50s and early 1960s, and made life in the South much more bearable than it ever had been previously, contributed to a population rise there. Shopping centres away from downtowns spread rapidly, particularly in the Sun Belt cities and the new suburban communities. The shopping centre should be surrounded by ample free parking. And the entrepreneurs understood that shopping was itself a leisure activity rather than something people did simply for necessities. The baby boom children born in the 1940s and 50s enjoyed more luxurious circumstances in their lives than any previous generation of Americans, and often dramatically different from that of their own parents who'd grown up in the Great Depression. America's population rose from about 140 million in 1945 to 200 million in 1967, a very, very rapid increase in a short period of time. This was because the birth rate was high, but also because the infant mortality rate was low. Improvements in medicine in the mid-20th century meant that far fewer children died than had ever been true previously. Improvements in medicine also increased longevity so that more people were living longer. More people could enjoy old age than ever before. And childhood and adolescence became distinct categories of life in their own right, to which entire industries were dedicated. Marketing and entertainment and psychology all now recognized that infancy was one stage, childhood another, adolescence a third, young adulthood a fourth, and so on. Because in the 50s, marketing people realized that children and adolescents themselves had disposable income and that it was worthwhile targeting certain products towards them. One of the most spectacular examples of this is Disneyland, which was founded in Anaheim, California in 1955, and it was marketed principally towards children, although also with a secondary advertising campaign for the adults who accompanied the children to visit this great place. And Disneyland's fascinating from a historian's point of view because it included idealized versions of what the nation's history was really like. For example, when you went into Disneyland, you entered into Main Street, and it was like an idealized rendering of what America had been like in about 1900. Walt Disney himself wrote a lot of the blurbs to go with these places, and here's his description. Quote, "For those of us who remember the carefree times it recreates, Main Street will bring back happy memories. For younger visitors, it is an adventure in turning back the calendar to the days of grandfather's youth." This is a claim we often hear, that life 50 years ago was much morally purer and less stressful than life today. This isn't very often true, but certainly it's an argument which is often made. From Main Street, you'd go on to Frontier Land, which is an idealized version of the American frontier. Quote, all of us have to have cause to be proud of our country's history, shaped by the pioneering spirit of our forefathers. Our adventures are designed to give you the feeling of having lived, even for a short while, during our country's pioneer days. And so from frontier land, you'd go on to fantasy land. And here, quoting the lyrics of the song, When You Wish Upon a Star, this is a fantasy land, is a place where dreams can come true. Walt Disney wrote, what youngster has not dreamed of flying with Peter Pan over moonlit London? Or tumbling into Alice's nonsensical wonderland? In Fantasyland, these classic stories of everyone's youth have become realities for youngsters of all ages to participate in. So the whole place is really dedicated to idealized recreations of a fanciful American past and enjoyment for children. A big place and expensive too. It was also in the 40s and 50s that groups like the intense teenage fans of Frank Sinatra arose, the Bobby Soxers, or a little bit later, the fans of Elvis Presley. At the adult end of the entertainment scale was something even more astonishing, the creation of Las Vegas, created just after the end of the Second World War by Benny Siegel, whose nickname was Bugsy Siegel. He was the founder and builder of the Flamingo Hotel, the first one. And Las Vegas, it's every foreigner visiting America, including me, loves to go and see it because it's so astonishing and it's clearly impossible that it can be there. An entire city in the middle of the desert dedicated entirely to surplus money and entertainment. Here's the historian Stephen Birmingham describing it. He says, from the first days of the Flamingo onwards, Las Vegas has grown from a dusty crossroads of sand and sagebrush to a glittering Oz-like metropolis with a permanent population of well over 500,000. An entire city supported by and devoted to a single pastime, gambling. It is Benny Siegel's city. In Las Vegas today, his name is spoken with reverence and awe. He is to Las Vegas what Benjamin Franklin is to Philadelphia. Now, the thing about Las Vegas is that it's the state with the lowest annual rainfall in America. Most of it is desert. And it was the one state in the Union which permitted gambling in the 1940s. Las Vegas is where it is because that's the part of Nevada which is closest to Los Angeles, which itself has the biggest population of people who might want to avail themselves of gambling. And Siegel's own gamble in building the Flamingo paid off royally. It became an incredibly attractive place and demonstrates how much surplus money there was available in America, since virtually nobody needs to go there, and because the house always wins, virtually nobody comes away from Las Vegas with more money than they had when they arrived. The late 40s and 50s is a period when citizens' mobility was increasing rapidly. Possession of automobiles was becoming almost universal. Already, at the time of the Grapes of Wrath in the 1930s, you sometimes see processions of poor Okies driven off the land, but they're in cars. And to have poor people in cars is very suggestive, I think, because so recently the car had itself been a luxury good. Now nearly everyone's got one. Even in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, which we'll 50s and 60s, which we'll look at next time, you see poor black citizens in cars. The luxury good has become a necessity. The interstate highway system was built in the 1950s and proved an immense stimulus to the economy. Eisenhower supported it, and it had, in part at least, a defense rationale. In other words, if we have a well-made, rapid, nationwide transit system, we can move supplies and men very quickly from one place to the next. The 50s was also the decade in which airline travel began to replace the trains. As I mentioned earlier, right from the time of the completion of the first transcontinental railroad back in 1869, the great way to travel, especially if you're going long distances, was by train. And the luxury trains were the apogee of luxury. But now, it's going by plane instead, because it's very, very quick. At first, of course, not many people could afford to do it because the prices were high. And so the prestige of being able to travel by air was high. That was a high status thing. The first generation of air hostesses, as flight attendants used to be called, was a very coveted job for a young woman to hold. Well, in the 50s, high employment and high wages enabled most home-owning families to rely on a single wage earner. It was now a realistic possibility for a large part of the American workforce to have dad go off to work and mom to stay home with the kids. And the sort of social normal assumption in a lot of 50s literature was that mom will be home looking after the baby boom kids, of whom there were often 5 or 6 or 7. Here's Tom Wolfe again, exaggerating, but in a way which tells you a truth, even while exaggerating the truth. He says, ordinary working people's prosperity in the middle of the century. Quote, "This is the century in which America became the richest nation in all of history, with a wealth that reached down to every level of the population. The energies and animal appetites and idle pleasures of even the working class," the very term seemed antique, "became enormous, lurid, creamy, preposterous. The American family car was a 425 horsepower, 22-foot-long Buick Electra with tail fins in the back and 2 black rubber breasts on the bumper in front. The American liquor store delivery man's or cargo humper's vacation was 2 weeks in Barbados with his 3rd wife. The way Americans lived made the rest of mankind stare with envy or disgust, but always with awe." Well, he's really onto something there. The scale of it all and the way in which it was so widespread really was something new in the world. And I've mentioned earlier how Singer, the sewing machine manufacturer, had begun the idea of consumer credit, how it had been extended again in the 1920s for installment payments on things like cars and washing machines. It was vastly extended further in the 1950s as the United States started to depend almost entirely upon credit. It expanded 800% between 1945 and 1957, with the result that nearly every family could live beyond its means, at least for a while. Now, of course, all kinds of anxieties accompanied the new affluence. I've already mentioned the Cold War setting in which this is taking place. Of course, the shadow of nuclear war, which seemed very, very close in the late 40s and early 50s, tempered the national optimism. Children at school were required to practice civil defense drills, that is, simple techniques of trying to shelter themselves in the event that a nuclear bomb went off, not close enough that they'd be instantly vaporized, but close enough that perhaps the windows would shatter and they might be able to protect themselves, subsequently being much parodied as a pointless activity. In the early 1960s, there was a great craze for building your own fallout shelter, and many mail order companies made a fortune by selling prefabricated fallout shelter kits. So, in your suburban back garden, you could dig a big trench, install the fallout shelter, and fill it with non-perishable canned food, so that when the nuclear war came, your family could get in there and survive. But then the question came up, what happens if your neighbours didn't bother to build one of their own? Are you ethically right if you defend your own fallout shelter with a gun against your desperate neighbours' attempts to get in? That's one of the questions which disturbed the press and the nation for a while in the early 1960s. American intellectuals in the 1950s worried that although America was certainly becoming a wealthy society, it was becoming excessively conformist, that it was losing the distinctive individuality which had made America great in the first place. Perhaps the most influential book to make this case is called The Lonely Crowd by David Reisman, which argued that American individualism was in decline. Reisman uses a kind of social psychology model, saying, if we look at people in traditional societies, individuals are tradition-directed. They take the view, this is what we do, this is what we've always done, and this is what we're going to continue to do. In other words, you fit into a tradition with the expectation that life will always carry on the way it does now. By contrast, said Reisman, the Industrial Revolution created the inner-directed personality. That is the person who, guided by what Reisman called his inner gyroscope, is highly directed towards changing the world in particular ways, has a very high degree of self-confidence, and goes after his goals single-mindedly. That's the personality type which made him, which created this amazing, abundant America. But now, Reisman argued, the inner directed personality is being displaced by the other directed personality, the kind of person who doesn't have the absolute self-confidence of one of the great entrepreneuring pioneers, but who instead is weak in internal resources and instead gets his or her validation by looking outside to others, the reassurance which comes from being part of a group or part of a team. Conformity, Reisman argued, is becoming the normal characteristic of the American other-directed personality. In 1956, William White published The Organization Man. And this, too, is on the rise of the corporate personality, the man who values teamwork and cooperativeness and belongingness much more highly than individuality. There's a marvellous film depiction of the Organization Man in the Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine film, The Apartment, which comes from the late 50s and early 60s, where Jack Lemmon works, he's one of hundreds of men working on identical desks, and the view you get of the corporation is of this awful anonymous place. But he's trying to rise in the company by lending his apartment to senior executives so that they can take their mistresses there. And it's all about what follows when he has a romance with the elevator girl, Shirley MacLaine. Anyway, it's a kind of a movie version of William White's description of the Organization Man. A lot of fiction took up the same themes as well. In 1955, a bestseller was The Man in the Grey Flannel Suit, a stifled, unhappy businessman who certainly materially successful, but feels that the material success is turning to ashes because he's no longer fulfilled as an individual. He's just become part of the rat race, and his family also are losing their distinctiveness. Similarly, John Keats's The Crack in the Picture Window from 1956. It calls America, quote, a homogeneous post-war hell of work, greed, and duplicated monotony. Well, reading a lot of this literature today, what strikes me anyway so strongly is this, that it's totally different from the kind of literature which was being produced by American novelists in the 1930s. If you compare this literature with Steinbeck, Steinbeck's is the literature which dealing with people whose poverty is very real, who've got pressing and urgent material things to worry about. These 50s novels are all about psychological anxieties. They're diffuse questions. They're about anxiety. Nobody's talking any longer about the danger of going hungry. So a different mood. It's the dissatisfied literature of success. Other intellectuals pointed out in the 50s that advertising was more and more shaping Americans' view of themselves and their world. In 1957, Vance Packard produced The Hidden Persuaders, and it's a study of motivational research by advertisers and the way in which they attempt subliminal advertising. They experimented, for example, in movies with including a photograph of an ice cream, which would just be on the screen for a tenth of a second, too quick almost for your eye to pick it up consciously, but your subliminal mind would get the message that you wanted to have an ice cream so that when the interval came, you'd go out and buy one, this kind of thing. Packard followed it up with a book called The Waste Makers in 1960 on the wastefulness of American packaging policy. And the historian David Potter wrote an influential study of the American character called People of Plenty, in which he pointed out that in America of the 1950s, far more money was being spent on advertising than was being spent on either education or religion. In other words, if you compare where people get their ideas from, church, school, and the ads, most of the money going into those things is going on the ads, and that's surely a deplorable state of affairs. Stories at the end of the Korean War showed that American prisoners of war, prisoners taken in Korea, had been very vulnerable to brainwashing. That is, they hadn't had the inner psychological resources to resist the mental assault on them of their captors. This also seemed like further evidence of the decline of the internal gyroscope. So parents understandably worried about their children's future in this complex world. One concern was about juvenile delinquency. And movies from the 50s like Rebel Without a Cause, one of the famous James Dean films, or Marlon Brando's The Wild One, is of what's going to happen when youth become completely alienated from the demands of our society. Paul Goodman wrote Growing Up Absurd, a book about what he thought of as the futility of modern education, saying many of the challenges of manhood, which earlier generations of men had to pass through, have been denied to this generation. They live too cocooned by comfort and luxury to be able to grow up properly. Was American public education good enough? Could it meet the era's challenges? Another bestseller from that period is Why Johnny Can't Read. The launch of the Soviet Sputnik galvanized all these fears in 57 and led to passage of the National Defense Education Act to strengthen scientific and technological training in American schools. So it's a period of anxieties as well as an era of luxury. One thing that some Americans didn't even realize at the time, although it's very clear looking back on it now, is this, that American culture enjoyed greater worldwide prestige than ever before. And in some realms of even artistic life, America was becoming the world's leader. American literature, for example, no longer needed to defer to European masters. It was a period of immense creativity in American literature. Norman Mailer, who I mentioned last time, Saul Bellow, Mary McCarthy, J.D. Salinger, who published The Catcher in the Rye in 1951, Ralph Ellison, the author of Invisible Man, Arthur Miller, whose play The Crucible I mentioned last time. These are writers of the first rank who didn't have to defer to European models in the way that most of their American literary predecessors had had to do. So incidentally, in the 1960s and 70s, some supporters of the counterculture looked back on the 50s and said of it that it was an era of numbing conformity. That's really only part of the picture. It was also a period of enormous literary and artistic creativity. New York became the capital of the art world in the 1950s, and a succession of very, very interesting art movements illuminated America at that time. In the 50s, particularly, abstract expressionism, with the work of artists like Willem de Kooning, Morris Lewis, Mark Rothko, and Jackson Pollock. Pollock's probably the most famous of these. He was the man who, instead of painting, his early career, he painted in a conventional way on canvas with paint. But then eventually he took to this method of dripping paint onto the canvas from sticks and brushes held above it. One of his great masterpieces is called Lavender Mist, and it's made entirely by dripping paint onto the canvas. And what Pollock liked about it was the fact that it was a little bit random. He wasn't going to be able to tell exactly how the painting would turn out, although he certainly learned how to manipulate the drips and the splashes in just the right way. Of course, his work was controversial. Some people hated it as the personification of all that's wrong with modern art, but others loved it. His nickname was Jack the Dripper because of the way he dripped the paint onto the canvas. Then in the early 1960s, a powerful American art movement was pop art. The great figures there were Andy Warhol, who made a fortune painting Campbell's soup cans, or painting what looked like deliberately bad photographic reproductions of Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe. Or my own favorite among the pop artists, Robert Rauschenberg, who did this hilarious sculpture called Monogram, which is of an old stuffed goat with a ruined tire around its middle. Funny, comical works like that. Claes Oldenburg, who made giant hamburgers or gigantic clothespins, an inflatable typewriter. And perhaps the most famous of them, Roy Lichtenstein, who did enormous canvas paintings of individual scenes from comic books, massive enlargements of what until then had been thought of one of the very lowest forms of vulgar popular art. The idea of the pop artist was to dissolve the distinction between high art and the popular arts, and in a sense to challenge the whole idea of the artistic avant-garde. The international style of building, which had begun in Germany with the Bauhaus movement, became very popular in post-war America for the building of skyscrapers. It became one of the dominant styles in cities like Chicago and New York and set standards for the rest of the world. By the 50s, American corporations were dominating the world and exporting American products almost everywhere. Coca-Cola, Kodak, General Motors, Ford, Levi's, Exxon, ITT. These are companies whose products were showing up almost everywhere. And the 50s was also a golden age for American universities. I mentioned how rapidly the college population was swelling. At the same time, the university's research apparatus was swelling greatly, creating far more spaces and opportunities for intellectuals than had ever been true before. Now, in 1958, one of the great books of the 50s was published. This is John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society. And this was a book which gave one of the names to that era. It points out many of the strengths and weaknesses of a suddenly very wealthy society. Galbraith begins the whole book with this lovely sentence. Wealth is not without its advantages. And the case to the contrary, though it has often been made, has never proved widely persuasive. It's a fabulous sentence, isn't it? But then he goes on to say, unfortunately, just because we've got the money doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to use it right. He goes on like this. Wealth is the relentless enemy of understanding. The poor man has always a precise view of his problem and its remedy. He hasn't got enough, and he needs more. The rich man can assume or imagine a much greater variety of ills, and he will be correspondingly less certain of their remedy. Also, until he learns to live with his wealth, he will have a well-observed tendency to put it to the wrong purposes or otherwise to make himself foolish. Well, then Galbraith goes on to explore the ways in which money is in fact being spent to show how different it is from the way in which money ought to be spent. His principal point was, we're living in an unbalanced society in which at the moment immense resources are put to private good, but in doing so, we're starving the public sphere of adequate funding. He was a Democratic Party loyalist who favoured a continued expansion of the role of the New Deal government, making the federal government the arbiter of all the other participants in society to make sure that the public realm developed commensurately with the private sphere in American life. And that's certainly one of the manifestos on which the Democratic governments of subsequent years acted. Next time, we're going to look at the group which most emphatically was left out of the prosperity of the 50s, that is the African-American community.